A couple of announcements. One is that on Saturday, right, we're going to have a one-day sitting at the First Unitarian Church from 9 to 4:30, and anybody who's interested can come and join us. However, if you're going to stay for lunch, you should bring your own bag lunch, and if you are going to meditate on the floor, you should bring a mat to sit on since it's a hardwood floor. And also, one of our Sangha members has generously written, typed up, and published a newsletter for us. And so, if you want, it has a schedule of some of our events on the newsletter. So, that's available on the table out there for March and April. Anything else? Yeah.
I would like to ask those of you who have not signed up yet for the Memorial Day retreat, please sign up with me as soon as you can. And that right about now, we'll be taking either the full payment or just deposit. The full payment is $55 for the entire week. We'd like a deposit, I mean, weekend. We'd like a deposit of $30. So for those of you who have already signed up with me, at your earliest convenience, I'd like some money, please.
Yes?
The book group is going to begin a new book the first Monday in April. We've been studying Jack Kornfield's book, Path with a Heart, Path with Heart. And we meet at 6:30 on Monday before the meditation at 7:30, so we meet for an hour. The book we're going to study is Everyday Zen by Charlotte Joko Beck. You're welcome to join us. If you have any questions, you can see me afterwards.
We're updating the directory, which we use for a once in a blue moon mail book. And for people who've already put their names in and on the directory, we have a printout. We're asking everybody to check very carefully, and especially the numbers, like zip codes and addresses. And if it's correct, put okay. And if not, make a change. And if you're not listed in the directory and would like to be, there's on the table, there's a sign-up sheet. So we would like for you to do that this week or next week.
Greg?
Two announcements. One is that Wednesday night meditation before meeting out at 7 o'clock. And that, I just want to remind people that on the 1st, there's going to be a workshop here in Palo Alto by Deborah and George Taylor on the relationship to spiritual practice. And there should be flyers out on the table.
I'm going to be going down to the retreat in Yucca Valley that's starting on April 8th. And I'm looking for a ride if there's anybody else who, in the sun, is planning to go. So I just thought I'd put myself out there to see if anybody else is driving down. I might be able to share a ride.
Okay. I wanted to talk this evening about intention, because intention is so centrally important to Buddhism and to Buddhist practice. And I came across this quote, which I thought would be a nice way of opening the talk, by someone named William Arthur Ward. And this person says, "The momentary thrill of getting rarely equals the lasting joy of giving." And I kind of like that, because I think in some ways it's very true that in giving, there's a sense in which the satisfaction, the happiness, the rejoicing even, that can come from acts of giving can last a person's whole lifetime. Whereas if you get something, you know, it lasts as long as you have it, or perhaps not even that long. And what this points out to me is that there are different consequences to our actions, or to actions, and that something looks very similar, giving and getting. Maybe they're opposites, but they're same. They belong together. that both of them can be intentional actions, that it can be your intention to get something, it can be your intention to give something, and there are very different consequences from which one you choose. When I was a child, I used to think a lot about causality, and mostly physical causality, and I used to be amazed at why things happened when they happened. And I used to kind of fantasize or imagine, if I was walking across the street and the car kind of rushed in front of me and missed me by a foot or something, what would have taken for me to have been one foot further into the street? Maybe it's because the person kind of a block away had asked me for the time, and therefore I was 1 foot away. Or maybe someone, didn't do something for me, and so then I was one foot further forward, and the car would have hit me. Or, and when you start thinking about the causal things during the day that might have kept me one foot forward or 1 foot back, they were infinite. You know, all these little steps, could have delayed me or accelerated me through the day. So where was the causality of it all? What was the cause and effect relationship? And I thought it was just an amazing kind of game and mystery to find myself in this world where the smallest little differences that seem inconsequential at the time that they happen could have huge consequences, major consequences, an hour later because they delayed you 1 foot or accelerated you 1 foot in your walk or whatever happened. Life is full of accidents in that kind of way. I mostly thought about it from the physical point of view, kind of physical causality of. Buddhism puts a lot of stress on understanding causality also, and cause and effect relationships. The Dalai Lama is supposed to have said that it's much more important to teach someone or to study causality or cause and effect relationships than it is to study or understand some of the deeper teachings of Buddhism, like the teaching of no self or the teaching of emptiness. And apparently the reason that he taught that is that the teachings of no self and of emptiness lend themselves to abandoning personal responsibility. But if you understand causality really well, the cause and effect relationship between the things you do and what happens in the world, you're much less likely to abandon your responsibility. So he said that's more important, is to teach conditionality or causality. And over again, you find in the history of Buddhism a tremendous emphasis on causality. Zen Master Dogen has a fascicle that's titled Deep Belief in Causality. Whereas as a child, I used to think about physical causality and play games with it, Buddhism puts much more stress on, couldn't think of a good word for it today, but psychological causality or mental causality. The causality that has to do with our psychic world. And our psychic world is immense. And most of us live in a psychic world in the sense that the world of our imagination, our ideas, our thoughts, our intentions is the world in which we mostly find ourselves in. Either our own or our fellow human beings' intention and mind. So sitting here in this room, as you know, there had to be someone, this room had to exist in someone's mind first, and then someone had to intend to create it. So the physical environment in which we find ourselves in now is in a sense thought created. Is it created out of intention? And so much of our world that we find ourselves in is that psychic world. And one of the key components, key elements of this psychic world or the thoughts-filled world or whatever you want to call it, is intention and understanding intention. So in looking at causality, Buddhism has tended to look at the intentional, psychic level of causality and not so much at the physical level. And the reason I think it looks at the psychic or the intentional level is that's the level, of course, where most suffering occurs. And the way that Buddhism talks about causality is through the teachings of karma. And the teachings of karma is, that's found in Buddhism, is very different than what's found in other Indian religions. And it's probably different than the kind of popular notion of karma you find in the West nowadays. I think it's fairly common. Probably it's in a dictionary even, the word karma. But the word karma has entered our popular vocabulary, at least since the 60s, if not earlier. And you find all kinds of somewhat metaphysical claims with the title karma. For example, one of the more insidious claims is if someone gets sick, then someone might say, oh, it's because of that person's karma. Someone gets cancer, oh, it's that person's karma. And often the implication is that the person's responsible for getting sick. It's because something they did in the past, therefore they're responsible. Or people talk about good karma when maybe in the West we would have said in times past, good luck. Someone finds, you know, money. Oh, you have good karma. Okay, good luck. Or what is it? Good karma, does that mean you found the money because something you did in the past? Or is it just, you know, coincidence? A lot of coincidences get metaphysical justification are used for justifying, I think, a lot of metaphysical claims. The notion of karma in much of Indian religions had a kind of absolute quality to it, that it was kind of the absolute law of karma, that if you did A, then B resulted. If you did, there was kind of a one-to-one kind of, it was kind of like almost like this book of justice, you know, somewhere. Buddhism doesn't exactly have kind of a god with this book or whatever, but it's almost like there's a tally sheet that's somewhere recording all the good and bad things you're doing, and then sooner or later it's going to balance them out. And if you did a lot of bad things, you're going to get a lot of bad things happen to you, kind of one-to-one correspondence. It's somewhat of a simplistic Indian religious idea. And the notion, that kind of idea is found in Buddhism at times, I think in part because it's a very effective way of teaching social, I don't know if responsibility is the right word, but keeping a way of providing for social control, keeping people moral in some way. Just like in the West we had God with his law books and his kind of sense of justice, people were worried about what kind of retribution and judgment they'd get on Judgment Day. So they lived a moral life, not because they felt like it, but they were afraid of what would happen. In the same way in India, many people lived a moral life because they were afraid of what happened because of this so-called absolute law of karma. But this is not the way that Buddhism has understood it. And Buddhism has a much more nuanced discussion of what karma is. And you can see it in the definition the Buddha gave to the word karma. The word karma literally means something like action. It's a neutral word, just means action, any kind of action at all. But the Buddha said, what I call karma is intention or motivation. That he wanted to equate karma with intention, and not all actions in general, but just those actions which are intentional. And that's a huge difference. So one of the contrasts people make between Buddhism and Jainism is in Jainism and other Indian religions contemporary to the Buddha, to Buddhism, teaches that all actions have karmic repercussions. So if you go outside here in the dark and step on an ant and kill the ant, that creates negative karma for you, which is going to have to be worked off or in the future. And so the Jains spend a lot of time sweeping the path in front of them as they walk, or filtering the water, or trying to do as little as they can to upset anything, even unintentionally. Buddhism says unintentional actions, if you don't know you're killing an ant and don't plan on it, there's no karma created in the sense that there was no intentional action done, so no intentional consequence arises in the future. So still Buddhists are careful where they walk, but things happen, and if you didn't intend them, then there's no karmic problem to that. There might be other consequences to it, but they're not karmic. They're not in this realm of karma. So what has moral or ethical consequence from the Buddhist point of view is our intentional actions. And in some ways, you could almost say that Buddhism is a religion of intention, and that it puts intention so centrally at the heart of the matter. And often, one of the most useful things you can do in your life when you have difficulties or problems, you're trying to resolve something, is to try to understand what is your intention behind it. And the often our intention is sometimes hidden, and or even if you know what your intentions, you might try to understand, you know, what is the quality of that intention? Is the quality of the intention one that's being motivated by hate? Or is the quality of that intention something that's motivated out of love or compassion? So two actions that can be look exactly the same can have very different intentions and therefore very different consequences. So if you're walking along with a friend down some public street somewhere and there's someone begging, one person might give money to the beggar because out of compassion, out of care for that person. Another person might give money to the beggar, and it looks the same from the outside, but what they want to do is impress their friends. So the friend has an impression that they're a generous and great person. The intention is very different, and therefore the consequence is different also. And often the one way of understanding consequences is there's consequence in the moment, in the present moment. In the present moment, what's the consequence of giving something out of compassion and care? And what is that? I would venture to say that probably the person who gives out of compassion and sense of sharing, and the consequence is a more sense of connectedness with that person, a more sense of open-heartedness, a kind of a sense of lightness, maybe even a sense of joy in having helped someone or whatever. The person who gives because they want to make a good impression on their friend, they're going to have a different consequence, I believe. And what's that going to be? Well, it depends. Do they want to impress their friend because they're motivated by fear about what their friend might do if they don't have their friend's esteem? So that I think that kind of giving, even though it's a generous act, might have the feeling, it might actually close a person down and make a person more close-hearted, actually, rather than more open-hearted. Very different consequences in the moment. And then what are the long-term consequences of such repeated actions? One way of understanding the notion of Buddhist karma, one of the most simplest ways, and maybe more mechanical ways of understanding it, is that it has to do with habit. You do certain things over and over again, intend certain things over and over again, and soon enough it becomes a habit. And then you're kind of responding and reacting to the world out of habit rather than out of some kind of wisdom or understanding. And the more you do something, the stronger you kind of make the muscle of that particular habit. And because of the power of habit, it's said in Buddhism, you should be very careful about what you do regularly and what the intention is behind it. Trungpa, the teacher, Tibetan teacher, once was asked, what is it that gets reborn? And he said, it's your bad habits. And there's some truth to that in the Buddhist understanding of rebirth. And when people give talks on intention, sometimes they give a couple of examples of the powerful consequences of intention. But these examples maybe aren't so good because they have to do with consequences in society, which is rather than karma, usually something much very personal. Karma has to do with how intentions comes back to you, affects you, the consequences on your in yourself, like you build up a habit or whatever. But the two examples I think are well worth saying. The one example is when the Buddha was, story from the Buddha when he was still a prince, and he left his palace to kind of, you know, check out the world for the first time. And first he saw a sick person, then he saw an old person, then he saw a dead person for the first time. He had lived a very sheltered life. And it made a big impact on him. And he's kind of started having existential questions about life and suffering and what to do about it. And he was troubled. The fourth time he left the palace, he saw a monk walking very serenely and at peace with himself walking through somewhere. And the peacefulness of that monk so inspired the Buddha that there was another possibility of living that he threw himself into his spiritual quest. the feeling is that this monk, it was the intention of this monk, of his practice, bore fruit and it inspired the Buddha. Another example is from King Ashoka, who is considered to be the greatest Buddhist king, emperor in India, is often held up as being the ideal model of what a Buddhist ruler should look like. But before he became a Buddhist ideal ruler, he was like the opposite, in that he was conquering most of India. He was one of the first people to unite much of India. And in the process of conquest, he and his army murdered, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of people. It was very gruesome. And one day he was walking in his, after a battle, and seeing the gruesome carnage left on the field. And on the edge of the field, he saw a monk walking very peacefully, at peace with himself, just walking calmly. And there's something about the peacefulness of that monk transformed this conqueror. And he thereby renounced war and lived the rest of his life in peace and did a tremendous amount of peaceful actions, acts of peace. So somehow the intention of this monk to live a life of peace was picked up by someone else. So these two are two examples of the power of intention, the power that intention can have on society. It's often said that Buddhism has come down to us because of King Ashoka's patronage. He became his patron for Buddhism, and if it hadn't been for him, it might have died out because it was kind of a minor movement. Intention is one of the seven universal factors of mind. In Buddhist psychology, they list many different factors of qualities of mind that could be present at different times. But there are seven factors which are always present, no matter what's going on. And I don't remember them all. Of course, I haven't memorized them, but there's things like awareness, mindfulness, energy, concentration. There has to be some concentration. There has to be some perception, some cognition. But one of the seven is intention. That every act of consciousness, every act of the mind, every moment of the mind, has intentionality within it. And that's kind of awesome, if that's true. That every moment, every state of consciousness we find ourselves in has some quality of intentionality in there. There's something being intended. And if that's true, are we responsible for that intention? Are we aware of what it even is? And are we, you know, are we aware of it and are we taking responsibility for it? The American psychologist William James wrote, "My experience is what I agree to attend to. My experience is what I agree to attend to." And are we aware of what that agreement is? And that agreement, in part, I think, has to do with intention. We intend certain things. And you can see it, you know, in small ways. If, I'm looking to buy a couch for our new house. I see couches everywhere now. And I see, you know, I walk down the street, and you know, I see couch stores. You know, I never noticed couch stores before. You know, and I have this intention to buy a couch. And it's kind of affecting the way I see my reality, my world around me. And I edit out my reality, that which relates to my intention. And I think this process of editing out of our reality, that which relates to our intention, relates to our agreement, relates to some kind of decision, is often the way we live our life. And that editing out, you know, can become a habit. So there are some people who, in a situation, mostly will see the unpleasant aspect of the situation. They kind of zero in on that part. And other people in the same situation zero in on the pleasant aspects of that situation. Very different ways of editing our life, our reality. So the degree to which we edit out our reality, our experience of life, that editing out is the result of karma, is karma. And as you can see, I think it changes the kind of world you live in a dramatic degree. You can live in a very different world depending on how you edit the world that we live in or superimpose it with ideas. Intention is often called a seed in Buddhism. And as a seed, it's something that flowers or grows and bears fruit. And the consequence of karma in Sanskrit is called phala, which means fruit. The fruit of these seeds of intention. The Buddha said that it's not possible for anyone, he said, except the Buddha, to understand the karmic causes of what's happening. That to really understand the full, all the different elements of karma is an impossibility. He said you'll go crazy if you try. And sometimes it's clear. And so Buddhist psychology has all kinds of categories of karma. It's a very sophisticated system. And they talk about the immediate cause, they talk about the proximate cause, the sustaining cause, the supporting cause, the far cause, the obstructing cause, there's all these different kinds of intentions and causes that you can kind of that affect what's going on. And the different intentions that we make, we're kind of like these carriers of mixed intentions and a history of mixed intentions. And these different mixed intentions kind of overlap and affect each other and balance each other out and have all kinds of effects on each other. So it's very difficult to understand all these things, how they brought us down to the present moment. And what the present moment is much more than just our karma. And the Buddha very clearly, very, very clearly wanted to, he disagreed with any kind of attempt to claim that there was deterministic karma, or that all of our life is deterministic. That there's no choice, that everything we are now is completely a result of our karma in the past. He said there are many things which cause who we are now. And he was very clear, he also said that some sicknesses are caused by karma, but some sicknesses are not. And some are just because of the weather's gotten cold and wet. And he was willing to accept that. But the karmic, they didn't understand very much about physiology back in the Buddha's day. Or maybe they understood more than we do. I don't know which way to see it. But he said that bad thoughts, or unwholesome, usually they don't talk about bad, but unwholesome thoughts, or the quality of our thoughts, whether wholesome or unwholesome, will affect our blood. And that unwholesome thoughts will make unwholesome blood. And wholesome thoughts will make wholesome blood. And unwholesome blood will make for unwholesome sicknesses. And wholesome blood will make, I guess you don't have wholesome sicknesses, but wholesome blood makes for health. And I think many of us, anybody who meditates for any length of time, I think can see the tremendous consequence of even our thoughts and what the consequence on our body. And you can feel it can take a tremendous toll on our body to think in certain ways, certain stressful ways, certain kind of hateful ways. Self-hate is one of the most painful things for the body. So what we are today is a product of many things, and karma is one of those pieces, but many things bring us to what we are now. And you can't always understand what it is that has brought us to today. Sometimes you can, but sometimes you can't. What we can know is the intention with which we respond to where we find ourselves right now. And as you know, Buddhism teaches the idea of no self. However, if anything is our self, if we're going to take anything to be the self, probably the best candidate is our intentions, our motivations, and our volitions. That the only thing that we have any choice about, the only thing that we can have any maneuverability about, really, I think, is our intentions. And intentions in Buddhism, the word cetana, doesn't just simply mean a will to do something, or desire to do something. It's a little bit wider. It means not only the desire to do something, but the impulse or the drive to follow through and do it. So those two things. But that's what we have some choice about. What is the intention? How are we going to respond to this situation we find ourselves in? And sometimes we find ourselves in very difficult and painful situations. And how are we going to respond? What's our intention in that situation? Sometimes, things are really wonderful. You're meditating, and things are really peaceful and very quiet. And the neighbor dog starts barking. Or let's say not the neighbor dog, but let's say that an ambulance starts going outside and it really, you know, grates at you. One response to that is, you know, oh shit, it's upset my meditation. I used to be calm and it's really hard for me to concentrate now by this ambulance. That's one way, that's one intentional way of responding. Another way of intentionally is, oh, here's someone, an ambulance has a siren on because someone is in need. Someone is probably hurting or in pain. And you can use that to open your heart to that situation. Open your heart to some other person who needs something. And is, how do you respond? Do you use it to open your heart? And it's not so pleasant to open your heart. But I think it's much, I would venture to say, it's much, in some more deeper way, it's more satisfying to open your heart to another human being than to simply dwell in your own calm. As a meditator, my things like, or your spiritual practice, or things like your level of your concentration, your level of your mindfulness, or calm, or insight, or bliss, or joy, or ease, or all kinds of wonderful spiritual qualities. And I think it doesn't make much sense to measure your meditation practice or measure your spiritual life according to those things, because they're pretty, in some ways, pretty ephemeral. And I've seen how some people can have a tremendous capacity for concentration and go very deep in concentration in meditation. And they leave that state of concentration and they're still just as foolish as they were before. Nothing really happened. There's no wisdom there. But what seems to be much more important than the consistency or quality of your concentration is the consistency, the continuity, and the quality of the intention to practice, or the intention for one's life. Some 10 years ago or so, I met Les Kay for the first time, the local Zen teacher in Mountain View. And the first time I met him, I heard him give a Dharma talk. And I don't really remember what he said. What he said didn't really register too much for me. I don't remember what he said anymore. But what struck me so deeply and what was so inspiring to me was what I felt in him was 20 years of intention. For 20 years, day in and day out, he had placed his intention in the world of practice, to practice and practice and practice. And I could feel in his body, in his bearing, in his manner, in his, you know, I could feel those 20 years of intention. And I was really inspired. The fruit of consistent intention is huge. And you just keep the intention to practice, keep the intention to open up, to be present, to be compassionate, to be accepting. Keep that momentum going. Don't worry if you're poor at it. Don't worry if you feel like you're failing at it all the time. I think it doesn't matter if you fail, if you keep trying. I think the intention to keep trying is so much more powerful than maybe even succeeding from time to time. Chances are if you succeed, you kind of rest on your laurels and kind of don't try anymore. Your intention kind of gets weak. So the intention. It's very useful to spend some time thinking about what your intention is, recognizing what the intention is, and the quality, the characteristics of that intention. And one of the functions of longer retreats, it depends from person to person how long, but one-day retreats or longer retreats, is that in the concentrated or the kind of contained environment of consistent practicing, often what gets clarified is the intention in which we practice. I remember my first one-day retreats, I was doing Zen retreats where you're not supposed to move at all and mostly you're sitting with very little walking. And it was very painful for me. And I used to get up after the 40 minutes of walking, we had 40 minutes of sitting, we had 10 minutes of walking. And it was so painful for me, I'd get up and for the next 10 minutes my whole body was shaking because of the pain. And then by the time the 10 minutes was up, I was able to kind of, I was calmed down, and then I had to go back and sit. And this is not like, most people don't have it this extreme. And here in Vipassana, one day sittings aren't as bad. We'd let you know. But still, I was very grateful for the difficulty, because it was kind of like putting myself in a fire. And many of the intentions I had, somewhat idealistic intentions I had about my spiritual practice, kind of got burned up. They had no meaning in the context of that fire. And what really had meaning in that fire? What was left for me? What was the purpose? What was I doing there? What was my intention? What made sense anymore when my whole world was on fire with knee pain or with some other emotional pain or whatever might be going on? What kept me there? What was the intention? So a lot of superfluous kind of intentions fell off because I saw them clearly and they didn't hold up in the sustained context of the retreat. And I didn't see that. And I sat every day at home. You know, it was a lot easier. And my intention wasn't so clear. Because it's hard to discover one's intention. And sometimes it's better understood during longer periods of retreat time. So intention. And one variety of intention is such things as what's called in our tradition the wanting mind, which is maybe better translated as a thirsting mind, the craving mind. Those kinds of intentions have very different qualities than the intentions to wake up. So discover what is your intention in your spiritual practice or your awareness practice, your mindfulness practice. What is that intention? I think it's very useful to know that, and part of what it requires is some sense of why you're practicing, where you're going with the practice. You know, I often talk a lot about, less than I used to, I think, about there not being any goal in this practice, or practice without a goal. But that's not really true. You can't really practice without a goal at all. You can practice without an expectation of a goal, or without striving. Or your goal can be to have no goal, or your goal can be to wake up and accept the present moment as it is without having it to be any different. But you should have, everybody's going to have a different intention, spiritual or intention for their spiritual life. You should know what your intention is and decide whether it's a reasonable one, that it's something you can actually do. Can you really do this thing? And if you can really feel, oh yes, I can do this, I think you'll feel a lot more motivated, inspired to do this, to do a meditation practice or do a spiritual practice or do any kind of practice. You know, if your intention is to get enlightened, which it is for a lot of people when they first hear about Buddhism, it's a lofty ideal, but they don't have a clue what enlightenment is. It's just like this great ideal kind of word that seems really lofty. They don't have a clue what it is. And so they puff and trying to meditate, trying to get enlightened, but they don't know what they're doing it for. That's not so useful. But is there some way you can personally understand the intention, the purpose of this practice, so that it's possible for you to do this? Is the purpose to be more compassionate with yourself? Can you do that? Is the purpose to be more present for your friends or for yourself, to be more accepting? Is your purpose to compassionate, more aware, more accepting, more forgiving? There's a whole bunch of ways of saying this. And what is it for you? And is it something you can do? And do you know? And if you know that it's possible, you know what it is, are you clear on how to do this practice so it can help you get there? And get there might be to be right here. It might not be going anywhere, but are you clear about how the meditation practice, the mindfulness practice, works in a sense to get you there? And I think that's very important to think about that, to reflect on that. Maybe even disagree with me. That's important. I think that these are very important topics of understanding. And they're tremendously motivating. If you feel like this practice can work for you, and you feel confident it can work for you, you're much more motivated to do it. Often, when I first sit down, or sometimes I forget when I first sit down, and sometimes I do it in the middle of my sitting or something, I'll remind myself of what my intention is for sitting, why I'm sitting there. And it's so easy, I can watch my own mind, it's so easy for me to be more interested in some soap opera in my mind than it is to be interested in my breath. And the breath, you know, compare, you know, if you're kind of, I'm kind of half paying attention, half aware, kind of half motivated to sit there and meditate, the breath is not going to hold me much. Really what's going to hold me is this fascinating soap opera about something in my imagination. But if I remind myself of my intention, my motivation, and why I'm there, why I'm sitting there, and what it takes to follow through with that intention, and why following the breath, why being present in the moment, why noting what's happening in the present moment, why that is effective, why that's useful for following through with this intention, then it's a lot easier for me to choose to stay with my breathing or to stay with my meditation practice. Be clear on your intention. And what I do sometimes is when I have a sense of my intention, I do a kind of, I don't know if I can say this, it's useful for you, but this is something I do, is I do a kind of, I scan my body. I kind of scan through my head all the way down, scanning it to see if I can, if my intention is embodied throughout my body, or to see where my intention, where my body I can infuse or incarnate with my intention, so that my whole body is somehow stabilized by the intention. And so it's something in my whole body, it's an attitude in my body, it isn't just something, oh, it's a good idea. Kind of scanning. What I do when I scan, it feels almost as if there are different layers of who I am, different layers to my personality. And as I go through the body, it's like I'm settling down through deeper and deeper layers, so deeper layers can be informed by my intention. And then I'll end with just mentioning that, again, what I've said is that intentions are very important in Buddhism, and knowing what your intention is. And there's a lot of intentional practices that we do in Buddhism. Loving kindness practice is an intentional practice. There are the sharing of merit that we often do, sometimes at the end of a one-day sitting, or it can be done at the end of anybody. Some people do it at the end of each sitting, or the end of a Dharma talk. There's a sharing of merit where we say, whatever benefits, whatever merit we have acquired from having done this activity, may we share it with all beings for the benefit of all beings. It's an expression of intention to share for the benefit of others. The sharing of merit is an intention. The very intention to become more aware, the intention to be present, to awaken, that the Buddha had under the Bodhi tree, that's a very powerful intention. He sat there. The intention he sat on there has become legendary, in the sense that we've made it into legend by putting in his mouth, I believe, his vow that he was not going to wake. He was not going to move from that spot until he was fully awakened. And he sat with tremendous intention to become awake, or the intention of the Bodhisattvas of Buddhism. The intention to save all beings, to live one's life for the benefit of others. Tremendously powerful intention, which many people live by. And I think everybody who practices long enough at some point lives by that intention. There are vows, all kinds of vows that Buddhists make. There are resolves. In the deeper levels of mindfulness practice, a mindfulness teacher might teach you to do resolves, which are kind of using intention, the power of intention, in the practice itself in a very specific way. And there's many I could list, more of these kind of intentional practices that are found in Buddhism that we often overlook. And the last one to mention is the intention to live. That the understanding in Buddhism is that in order to live, there has to be intention. That there are four nutrients that keep us alive. And the four nutrients are food, sensory contact or sensations, feeling sensations. And the third is intention, mental intentions. And the fourth is consciousness. Those are the four foods that sustain our life. And when the Buddha, 3 months before the Buddha died, he, I don't know what the right verb is. He abandoned. He let go of his intention to live, and he made a choice according to the sutras. He made this choice, and I'm gonna give up my intention to live. And it took 3 months then for the biological being to kind of wind itself down. And you find in the history of Buddhism many examples. There's so many of them that I kind of believe it's true, but I don't know for myself. That of these stories of monks who monks or nuns or adepts who will decide their time of death and will enter into meditation and die in meditation, kind of intending to die, intending to let go of life, because it's time. They decided it's time. And I think we see it more commonly in our society when people are very close to dying and very weak and very sick. Sometimes the only thing that seems to keep them alive is a very strong intention, a very strong motivation. And finally they'll die when the intention and motivation, when they let go of that. Part, I think the focus on intention that Buddhism puts on us, the focus on intention, not only does it imply that there's a sense of personal responsibility, but there's also a sense that we are that really the agent for spiritual life is ourselves. And regardless of what you think of Buddhist teachings and no self, there is this core aspect of us that we have to take responsibility for. Yeah, Pesha.
If I have the intention of becoming more compassionate, isn't that also a wanting? You talk of the wanting mind, the grasping mind. Isn't that a wanting? Right.
Well, this is with the difficulty with the English word wanting. There are many different words in Pali, in Buddhist language, that gets translated as wanting. And some of them are considered wholesome and some are considered unwholesome. So usually the unwholesome wanting is things. I think it's better to say in English, to avoid this complication, is drop the word wanting from our Buddhist English vocabulary, and talk about intention, volition, motivation, aspiration. Talk about craving or thirst or clinging. So that kind of differentiates more the way the Buddhist language differentiates. So clinging or grasping tends to have problematic consequences, the karma of that. Whereas there are wholesome intentions which only make our life go smoother and better and kind of mature us as spiritual people. And it's possible to live a life that has a very strong intention for developing wholesome qualities of mind, wholesome qualities of the heart. However, that also becomes a habit. And so the warning in Buddhism is even wholesome things, even if you make yourself a really wholesome person, will keep you in some ways bound within a kind of constricted life. And to really have a boundless, unconstricted life that's free, you have to find some way to step outside with your awareness, with your consciousness, outside of both wholesome states of mind and unwholesome states of mind. And real freedom has very little to do with wholesome states of mind. However, wholesome states of mind make a very, very, very strong foundation upon which to become free. It's easier to be free if you have wholesome states of mind. But wholesome states of mind in and of themselves is not freedom.
What's a wholesome state of mind?
Compassion, loving kindness, generosity, goodwill, things like that. This is wonderful. There's a list of them. Someone asked me to bring the list, didn't they? There's a list of these different states of mind. And there are many. There are more wholesome states of mind than there are unwholesome states of mind. Isn't that nice? But is that your experience?
Different question. You said something about not knowing your intention. It seems to me intention is a consciousness or an awareness. And if you don't know your intention, do you have an intention?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, there's intention in every state of consciousness. Every moment of consciousness is some kind of intention. But intention isn't... I guess intention maybe in English is kind of like a big thing. Like your intention to go to school, or your intention to graduate, or your intention, you know, to get married. It's like a major thing, right? But I think the way they use in Buddhism is intent. It's volition or motivation are just as good words for this, cetana. So what's the motivation? And often our motivation is not clear. We're not even aware of it, I believe. And Buddhism says that itself. So there isn't the word unconscious, but there is... maybe it amounts to the same, but a more literal translation would be unaware motivations. Motivations in which you're not aware of. And I think it's pretty common. So maybe this is a good place to intend to stop. And then we can intend to get up and intend to walk out the door. I hope you intend to drive home carefully.